Good morning. We'll call the meeting of the House Ag Policy Committee to order. We do have a quorum, so we will be able to do, and the clerk will note the roll on who is here, but we do have some approval of some minutes. So Representative Faust.
I approve the move that we approve the minutes of the January 24th and January 31st minutes, please.
Thank you. Is there any discussion regarding that motion? Otherwise, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say no. All right. The minutes are approved. Thank you. We will have the bill, the House File 251, so I'll be going to the front. Representative Faust will be here. I just wanted to make a couple of announcements about that. I apologize that I did not put in any rules for this committee, but that is on purpose. Our rules are going to be determined as we go along to some degree, but there is no 24-hour rule. So I think that the two rules that I'm going to ask that we have are that we have respect and common sense as we move along, and if we need to develop something that's more specific to the way we operate, we will do that. But I think that this typically has been a committee that works cooperatively as we move along, and I do think we want to continue in that fashion, that's been the case under both Republican and Democrat leadership, and I think that we would like to continue that. And but I do apologize that I did not mention about the no 24-hour rule before we have our first bill, because maybe people were wondering about that. And so Representative Hamilton isn't here, so I did not have that discussion with him prior to this either. But just keep that in mind. If something moves you as we, you know, hear bills and you are thinking that you have a suggestion for a change, we'll be able to address that. We also do, though, hold the opportunity to keep bills in our possession until we have the bill in the way that we'd like to see it move on. So we will exercise that right. So I'm going to have Representative Faust take over here, and we will go to the table. We have some people for this bill.
All right, thank you, Representative and Chair Poppe, and proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do would like to move House File 251. And with the recommendation that as it passes, it would go to the House floor.
Okay. Representative Poppe moves House File 251. And so proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have people who are here to testify on behalf of the Farmer Lender Mediation Act, and we do have materials in our packet that will describe. There's a folder in the packet that from the University of Minnesota Extension that describes the farmer lender mediation. We will be hearing from testifiers regarding the initial purpose of creating the act and its ongoing sense of importance throughout the farming and agriculture community. So I would really like to just start with some people who are here to speak to the bill.
Very good.
So I think we have Dr. Sinise is going to begin.
Dr. Sinise, would you please pronounce your name for the tape so that we can get it recorded correctly, please, and go ahead.
Sure. My name is Dick Sinise. I'm Senior Associate Dean with the University of Minnesota Extension. I'm rarely called Dr. Sinise, so that's kind of, didn't quite recognize who we were referring to there. So, Chair Poppe, members of the committee, I'm here today to talk to you about a very important program created by the state legislature in the 1980s during a very difficult time for farmers and lenders both. I believe that the program data in the packet, which we'll talk about in just a second, shows that the Minnesota Farmer Lender Mediation Program is as important today for some farmers and lenders as it was when the program began. University of Minnesota Extension has been designated under state statute to manage the program since 1986 when it was created. Mediation makes use of trained, impartial mediators who bring together all parties involved in credit disputes to find solutions. The program has helped keep farmers and their families on the farm in most cases, and in some cases allows for needed operational transitions and downsizing in an orderly way. In all cases, the program creates the breathing room needed for all parties, creditors and debtors, to make the best possible decision. We have in your packet, I believe it's on the right-hand side, this flyer that describes how the program works. It's kind of a process overview of the program. So a creditor with a secured debt of more than $5,000 or more against an agricultural property offers mediation before proceeding with other actions, such as foreclosure, repossession, cancellation of a contract, etc. If the farmer borrower accepts mediation and they have 14 days in which to do so, Extension's team gets involved by setting up a meeting that includes the farmer, all the other co-borrowers, and as many of you know, these operations can be quite complex with co-borrowers, the initiating lender, all other creditors related to the ag operation, a financial analyst, and a mediator. Successful mediation relies on two things, neutrality and compromise. So neutrality on part of the mediator and compromise on part of both the parties, the borrowers and the lenders. Farmers may have to change the way they farm or perhaps even liquidate assets. Creditors may need to restructure debt or reschedule loan payments to make it work. The mediator leads and manages the discussion as a neutral party without making judgments or decisions. If mediation does not result in an agreement after 90 days, the parties involved are free to pursue whatever course of action was available to them prior to this, most often with a more clear understanding of the facts and the position of the other parties involved. There's another handout in your packet. On the left-hand side, it's an executive summary that describes the activities for federal fiscal year 2012. We operate the program on a federal fiscal year, so October through September. In federal fiscal year 2012, we received nearly 3,000 mediation notices were received from creditors. Now, under USDA rules, a notice refers to a unique credit obligation. For example, each loan or line of credit may have multiple entities or co-borrowers associated with it and obligated to repay the loan. So we have to issue a notice for each of these obligations. The total number of notices per operation varies. So while we saw 2,919 notices, there were 1,087 farm operations involved in that set of notices. The number of notices per operation varies from 1 to 286. So we have some small operations and a couple very large operations in here. The total amount of debt reported and addressed in mediation sessions this last fiscal year was just over $170 million. Also, a recent change in Minnesota law allows us to collect information on the amount of the initiating debt. On the back page of the executive summary is a table that shows how the initiating debt breaks down. So again, this is for cases that went into mediation. What was the amount of the initial debt reported to us that triggered the whole process off? This is not the total debt that was mediated in these cases, but just the amount of the initiating debt. On average, the median average is $230,000 is for the initiating debt. 11% of the cases had initiating debt of less than $15,000, and 20% had initiating debt of less than $45,000. The range is from $5,000 to $6.8 million of initiating debt. So again, a wide range of sizes of operations. While we don't have comparable data across previous years, these data do show that a fair number of smaller operations were electing mediation during this last fiscal year. So in summary, the Farmer Lender Mediation Program remains a stabilizing factor in the world of ag finance when farmers face debt problems. Despite record and near-record farm income in the last few years, for some farmers and their families, there are problems, often unforeseen, that can result in credit trouble, such as reduction of off-farm income, high medical bills, and a host of family dynamics that can really infringe upon the operation. Looking forward, we know there will continue to be, as there always is, some uncertainty in the farm economy. Farmers and lenders are very familiar with price cycles and bubbles, and even though we have seen record prices, the number of notices filed with the program in federal fiscal year 2012 was the fourth highest in the last 10 years. I'd like to introduce Marianne Preissler, who is the program director of the Farmer Lender Mediation Program. She's also one of our mediators. She's been with the program actually since its inception, and she can give you some firsthand knowledge of successes and what mediation looks like. And so, Mary Nell.
Thank you, and welcome here. Would you please state your name for the record and then proceed?
Hi, I'm Mary Nell Preissler. I'm the program director for Farmer Lender Mediation. What I was asked to do was to give an example of a typical mediation. There is no such thing. There is not a typical mediation. So I thought of one that communication was a problem. And this example is of a group of siblings on a dairy farmer. It's all a huge dairy farm that is family owned. But each of the people were responsible for a certain aspect of the part of the dairy. Everything went fine until they stopped talking to each other. And when that miscommunication came, also came a drought and the high grain prices. The communication had broken down to the point that it was destroying the profitability. Finally, they went in default with a bank. And after the bank had served them a default letter offering mediation, the bank called to ask if we wouldn't encourage them to attend mediation and if we couldn't help them to communicate. There were multiple creditors, both secured and unsecured, many creditors on Main Street businesses. And today, after a very long time of working together to create communication, started out with three different rooms to put three different individuals because they couldn't communicate. By the end of the first session, they were all in the same room and they were talking. Today, there is open communication, and it has pulled the family together instead of apart, and a feasible plan that they are still in the dairy business today. There are many stories like this. When asked to try and find a story, another one that came to mind was when you're trying to hand the farm over to another generation. That's very difficult to do. Better make sure you have all your ducks in the order that they should be, and that the creditors are working with you to try to bring that young person into that operation. Many times it involves many different types of creditors, the Young Farmer Program, but that is our future. I was turning over agriculture into the next generation. Any questions?
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Are there any questions for these testifiers? Otherwise, we'll go on to another.
Yeah, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To either testifier of the 1,087 different operations, do you have any further breakdown of how many involved livestock of some kind or were any strictly grain operations?
Sure. Let me grab that here. Representative Anderson, members of the committee, the primary commodities go in this order. Crop was 55%, cattle 18%, dairy 16%, hogs 5%, horses 4%, poultry 1%, and other 1%. So in terms of the distribution, most were 55% with crops. Right. The primary commodity of that operation.
Thank you very much. Any other questions for either of the testifiers? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed on the percentages that there were a significantly less number of percentages in the Northwest, the North Central, and the Northeast, and a very high percentage in the Central and East Central. Is there a reason for that, or is there?
Representative Anderson, yes, there is. And part of that is the high, anything that eats grain. And so we have a concentration of dairy in that area, so there would be more dairy. There would also be, because of the weather, We've had parts of Minnesota in a drought. We've had parts of Minnesota that's too wet. And that would probably be the drought areas.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any other questions? If not, all right, thank you very much for your testimony. And Mayor Poppy, you can bring down your next testifier, please.
Thank you. Right now we'll have Bruce Miller, who is with the Minnesota Farmers Union.
Very good. Welcome, Mr. Miller, and please state your name for the tape and proceed.
Good morning. Chair Poppy, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bruce Miller. I represent the women, men, and families of Minnesota Farmers Union. I appreciate the opportunity to speak briefly in support of House File 251, which extends the sunset date for the Farmer Lender Mediation Act. Minnesota Farmers Union has been a longtime supporter of the Farmer Lender Mediation Act. The program has been a valuable tool for Minnesota farmers working with their bankers to give them the opportunity to resolve disputes and allow farmers to keep farming. Despite record crop prices, it is not unusual for Minnesota Farmers Union to still refer farmers to the Farmer Lender Mediation Program. Right now, Farmers Union is working with several farmers who are struggling with high feed and hay prices. We also refer farmers to two other programs, the Farm Advocate Program in the Department of Agriculture and the Hotline MFAN as a part of the Department of Agriculture. These are two other good programs that work with the Farmer Lender Mediation Program to assist farmers who are having financial issues. Minnesota Farmers Union supports keeping, although this is a sunset bill, we also support keeping the $5,000 qualifying level, which is what it is currently. We need every type of farmer, and when we talk to farm advocates, they tell us that there are farmers, especially younger farmers, that would be hurt by raising the level, and that is not something we want to see happen. We are seeing new farmers entering farming, using low input methods. We're creating CSAs. And we also see a growing minority farming population. The $5,000 level and this program are of direct benefit to those populations. Thank you for your consideration of support. Thank you for this legislation. And Minnesota Farmers Union strongly urges you to support this legislation as presented to you today. And I would thank you. Thank you. And if there are any questions, I am here now and would be here later to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Do we have any questions for the testifier? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
And Chair Poppy, you may bring down your next testifier, please.
Thank you. Yes, and certainly as a part of the Farmer Lender Mediation Act, we have farmers that we've heard about, but we also have the lenders. And so we have Mr. Skilbred, who is going to talk to us on a perhaps different perspective. Regarding the bankers and the lenders for this.
All right. Thank you or welcome, Mr. Skilbred. Please pronounce your name for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. David Skilbred, Vice President of Government Affairs for the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota. First, I'd like to thank Chair Poppy for allowing me to talk to her a little bit last week about this bill. And what I have to say today will parallel what we discussed just on Friday. My expectation is that this bill will pass today, considering its wide support. After all, similar sunset extensions for this program have been passed about a dozen times since the program was established in 1986. I'd like to offer a few reasons, however, why a sunset would be appropriate, and if it is not sunsetted, suggest how you could at least make one small change to modernize the program. The intent of the law in 1986, the agreement at that time was that this would be a temporary bill. Passed in 86, the first sunset was in 1988. It was responding to the unusual conditions of what we call now the farm crisis of the 1980s. And here we are today, some 27 years later, and we have this temporary bill still existing. The conditions of that time, the conditions were extreme, and two things come to mind. Number one, civil unrest, and number two, a huge drop in the ag economy. And this is confirmed by reading the findings to this law, which maybe you have before you. Statutes 583.21, and I'm just going to read a couple lines from that. The legislature finds that the agricultural sector of the state's economy is under severe financial stress. Thousands of this state's farmers are unable to meet current payments of interest and principal. The agricultural economic emergency requires an orderly process with state assistance to adjust agricultural indebtedness to prevent civil unrest and to preserve the general welfare and fiscal integrity of the state. I repeat, to prevent civil unrest. When this bill was passed, farmers and lenders were living in a whirlwind. The emotions were running very, very high. 13 farmers in 1986 descended on the Capitol at the peak of the crisis to have a rally. We have had a lot of people here at the Capitol this week, but I think that the 13,000 farmers in 1986 probably were more surprising to see and dwarfed the activity that we have had this week. That rally echoed another rally called a Tractorcade that was in 1979, where a lot of farmers drove across America in their tractors to Washington, D.C. to rally support. With respect to civil unrest, like I said, emotions were running very high. Two lenders were killed in southwestern Minnesota, so it was a very unusual time. Economic stress. Prior to the passage of this law, farm income dropped precipitously. Minnesota's net farm income dropped from $1.2 billion in 1980 to $208 million in 1983. Previous testimony has indicated what farm income is today, and it's very different than that. Farmer lender mediation was necessary at that time during those conditions. And according to one member of the conference committee of the bill, the biggest contribution the law made was to let some steam out of a boiling pot. Mediation by a neutral third party allowed a moment for people to stop, catch their breath, allow some of the emotions to dissipate, and then be able to better talk about the issues and the options and discuss what might be done. So things have drastically changed. Further evidence. The civil unrest and economic crisis no longer exist. Number two, farmers and lending have changed drastically since 1986. I'm going to quote Marinelle here, not quoter but paraphraser. I hope I get the quote right. But I read an article in which she said that in those early years, when farmers needed to bring in their financial statements to the mediation, some would come in holding a shoebox. Today, thanks in part to the Farm Management Program, also promoted by the state, farmers are some of our best and most articulate, literate business people. Farming and the paperwork that goes with it and the strategies that go with it have changed drastically. Lending has changed drastically too. Today, lenders are doing a better job of credit analysis and loan structure. Further, the equity asset-based lending model that was used often at that time has been replaced with a cash flow model. Today, lenders do not assume land or any other farm asset will increase in value. Rather, if a loan doesn't cash flow, the loan isn't made. This is the change lenders have learned and now our examiners demand. In short, this program was passed with an agreement to be temporary, recognizing that it was needed for extraordinary times. Its main contribution was to calm everyone down, let steam out of the boiling pot, to improve communications, negotiations, and hopefully the general welfare of the state. As one of my bankers told me recently, the farm crisis is over. Our bank doesn't need a law to make us negotiate with our customers. That's what we do. Our business model is based on relationships, and we will do all we can to make sure new loans are good loans. And when there are problems, do all we can to make sure that we work with the borrower to come to the best solution possible. Now, I said that I would make one suggestion to improve the law should you pass the bill, and this is the suggestion, namely to increase the trigger, the dollar amount that triggers farmer lender mediation. Current law sets that amount at $5,000. This amount hasn't been changed once since 1986. If it is the same today, 27 years later. For those of you who do farming and know farming and did farming back then, you know, I would encourage you to think about what you could get in 1986 for $5,000 and what you could get today. Finally, the size of expenses related to agriculture have increased just like everything else. Mediation may have some value for those large financial issues today with multiple creditors, but we believe it is not necessary or appropriate for a missed machinery payment. A missed machinery payment can trigger a farmer lender mediation. We think that it's not common sense to do so much over a relatively little event. With that, I'll conclude my testimony. If you have questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Thank you very much, Mr. Skubred. Do we have any questions for the testifier? Yeah, Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to Mr. Skubred. The idea that the threshold be raised, I know it's been brought up before, but I think the assumption was maybe made that as farms have gotten larger and as profitability has grown, we don't need this low threshold, but that doesn't mean that there still aren't small farmers. And so I think it's important, maybe just for the record, to reflect that we still have a number of small farmers where that gap between, say, $5,000 and $25,000 or $5,000 and $50,000 for mediation really is important, and they may not always be in the traditional areas of agriculture. I mean, they could be small, sustainable vegetable growing operations or other types of organic farms, and they don't have the huge investments in equipment or oftentimes fertilizer or other inputs that maybe you see in traditional agriculture, but it doesn't mean that they're not farmers. And so I just hope that we keep that in mind too, that there are a number of small farmers that greatly benefit from this provision.
Mr. Skubred, would you like to respond to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's very true. Farming has changed in a lot of different ways. And one of those things that we have today that we didn't have 27 years ago are these sort of micro farms that some of our immigrant people, for one, have started, are doing very well at. And that's true. And they are farmers for sure. But again, the program was created for something very different, and where those people get their loans, I'm quite sure that their lenders will work with them if there are defaults. And so using a hammer of sorts to initiate a negotiation, in my mind, seems unnecessary.
Thank you. No follow-up? Okay. Representative Kreshaw, is that pronounced right?
I do that every day. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Skilbred, just a quick, you're absolutely right. Farming has changed. And as someone who lost a family farm in the 80s, I absolutely understand this program and the merits. But one of the things that has changed is the types of farmers that we have, and you mentioned that. In my area, we have a very high Hispanic population. And one of the merits I see of this program that you actually attributed to was the cooling off. And sometimes, against our better judgment, we make decisions about people that we probably shouldn't. And when somebody gets in a tough situation, I see a program like this allowing some of those prejudices to be set aside so that they can talk through the loan and mediation. And so while I absolutely understand that banks are trying to do the best they can, but sometimes despite our best efforts as people, we make decisions we shouldn't. And so as I look at my Hispanic population, I see something like this as they're emerging just like we were in the late 70s. And I remember my grandfather wanted to participate in the tractorcade but couldn't because the tires he couldn't afford. Mm-hmm. And so I see 60 days as a point where everybody gets to step aside and say, let's talk this through and set aside some of the community issues. So I just wanted to speak to that and absolutely recognize that farming is changing in a lot of ways and that we have lots of reemerging farmers from different backgrounds who are going to make great contributions if we let them. So I don't know if you want to respond to that, but it's just something that I'm seeing in my area.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Skilbred, would you like to respond to that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Kreisha, I agree totally. No doubt those statements are accurate. I guess one of the questions, though, that comes to my mind is if you created a rather significant program for an extremely unusual time, should you preserve the program for a new time that has different factors, different experiences, but perhaps a relatively minor use? I didn't do the math on the sheet that was handed out before, but when you take those 3,000 notices and break them down into farms, you have a little over 1,000. And then of those, only a percentage go to mediation, and then of those, only a percentage have a successful mediation. So I guess the question boils down to, yes, it was created for a particular time. Do we care if that time no longer exists? And does it provide something now for a different time?
Yeah, go ahead, Representative.
And I think one compromise that I would actually offer up, instead of saying this was created for a particular time, was it not created for a particular situation? And that is the hardships of people emerging into the agriculture industry. And I would actually argue that those hardships haven't gone away. I also understand, as a former CFO, and have looked very closely at many of the bank balance sheets and understand the situation on that side. And so I would actually say, rather than coming back every couple of years, why don't we just make this permanent? It's such a small thing, and I'm sure today you would have better things to do with your morning, and I know I would, if we weren't doing this every 4 years.
Thank you, Representative Crusade. Would you like to respond to that, Mr. Skilbred?
I will pass to staff who might have an answer regarding the legal issue there.
Okay. Colby Sullivan, House staff, do you have an answer to that as to why we can't do this on a permanent basis?
Mr. Chair and members, no. I don't know if the question is about maybe the mechanics of the bill and how it would be amended to do that today. But otherwise, no, I don't see any reason why this body couldn't go that route if that's what they choose.
Okay. All right. Thank you. So later on, I guess, if you would like to make that amendment, we'll do that. But I don't think the time is right for that yet, so if we can. All right. Representative Wagenius, you have a question.
Thank you. Not so much a question as a comment. When you were talking about 1986 as being an extremely unusual time, it was unusual, and it was extremely unusual. But I just want to put on the record that in our committee, the Finance Committee, We had at the beginning one of our first sessions, Dr. Mark Seeley from the University of Minnesota came, and the piece of testimony that he gave that has stuck with me more than anything else was that he said that this year, when they measure soil moisture levels, they're measuring levels never before recorded, lower than anything ever before recorded. And when I reported that to some of the folks at the Department of Agriculture, they said, well, at the Lamberton Station, they are measuring zero levels of soil moisture. This is an extremely unusual time.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Skilbred, do you have any comments to make to that?
No.
No, okay. Are there any other questions or comments for Mr. Skilbred? Representative Anderson, sorry.
Guess we're too close to
pointing
see
to somebody.
Each other, yeah. So. I might as well add my 2 cents worth also. I agree with Representative Wagenius that this is a difficult time in terms of the environment, moisture situations, but I think what Mr. Skilbred is referring to is the economic time, and I bought a tractor back in 1980-something, and the interest rate was like 19%. Totally different in terms of the economic climate. Today we have interest rates historically low levels, and frankly I was surprised that the largest number of these mediation cases involved cropping operations. Those that have sold crops the last couple of years, for the most part, it's been a good time in agriculture. Dairy, hogs, beef, yes, I understand that buying these high-priced inputs makes it's been difficult, and I can see the merit of a program like that. And yeah, we've discussed before increasing this threshold from $5,000, and I guess I'd be interested in knowing the breakdown goes from $5,000 to $15,000. How many are in that $5,000 to $10,000 range? How many from $10,000 to $15,000? Because certainly we all agree, I would think, that since 1986, things have definitely changed in terms of inflation and things such as that. And I would just close by saying anybody involved in agriculture would have to agree that it has its risks. It's a gamble. When you put that seed in the ground in the spring, you're taking a gamble. And we know that, we understand that, and that's just an inherent part of agriculture.
All right. Thank you, Representative Anderson. Any response to that, Mr. Skilbred?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Anderson, I've got one response, and that is on the handout by the Extension Service, and then on the back side, it shows the initial debt in mediated cases by percentages. That information is available because of a law passed in 1999, which we initiated and supported, which required lenders to put the principal amount in default on the notice that they sent out to the debtors. And that notice then also went to the program. And so it was an attempt by us to gather information about, well, when the mediations take place, what amount of money is being mediated? I kind of thought at the time that perhaps you would show that the initial dollar amounts were significantly higher than $5,000. It doesn't show that. But I think what this shows instead is that lenders are conforming to the law. And regardless of whether it's practical or makes common sense or not, if there's a $10,000 loan that's in default, their only option is to conform to the mediation requirements and send out the notice. And that's why you've got 11% in that lower dollar threshold and 14% above. There are a lot of other items that we buy daily that have significantly more dollar amounts, and we don't go through mediation for those. So it seems to me that it would be appropriate 27 years later to finally take that $5,000 and increase it significantly.
Thank you. Representative Krusha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so you heard from one side of my brain, now you have to hear from the other side. as I think through on the number side and the financial aspect, are there costs or you had mentioned that, and I know the banks are very overregulated, and you had mentioned that you, as banking industry, you're trying very hard to build those relationships, and I understand how that works as well. Are there costs or adverse sides to this that we haven't heard or that you could maybe give an example of why this is a situation that puts undue stress in the banking industry?
Mr. Skillbred.
Mr. Chair and Representative Keisha, there are costs. One of the things that the mediation law does is set up a very strict timetable of notices and et cetera that need to be sent out. If the lender does not conform exactly to that timetable, then they lose their rights to continue, and you got to start all over. So there's a legal cost there oftentimes, and paying lawyers to do this sort of thing doesn't get anybody anything. That doesn't make a profit. It just helps the banks conform. Secondly, it does delay the process, and so the time spent by bankers to go to these meetings is significant. There's drive times to the meetings. One of my lenders just said that he went through a mediation. He went through 7 meetings and 24 miles one way to drive to the meetings. So he estimated, you know, several hours out of the bank to take care of that and to conform to that. And at the end of the day, a mediation, a negotiation was not successful. So he spent a lot of time, maybe spent some lawyer's fees, and that one didn't work.
Yeah, Representative Krusha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so a follow-up, do you see that, you know, if I were to be looking at the bottom line of this, do you see those unsuccessful attempts, the more costly mediation ones, at the lower end of the spectrum or the higher end? Because, I mean, if I were looking at this as a normal product and say, okay, these $5,000 to $10,000 mediations are costing us the most because of certain factors, do you have any numbers to support that?
Mr. Skillbred.
No, I can't tell you that. But what I can say is that the lender who told me that story said that mediation might be more appropriate for the high dollar amounts in question, which, as the proponents said, can often get very complex and can have numerous creditors involved. So at that level, it's perhaps more necessary. But at a lower level, just like if you buy a $10,000 used car and you miss a payment, you got to work with the dealer to figure out what's going to happen. Same thing with a $10,000 loan to a lender on some sort of farm product, some sort of ag product. You know, is it necessary that a default on that piece of machinery draws the whole farm, all of the land, all of the animals, all of the crops, all of the assets into the discussion? I don't know. We don't think it's necessary.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Skillbred. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Chairman, and thank you for your testimony at this time. But that leads me to the question. If I understand the law, maybe I don't, the bank or whoever has the loan on that particular process, they don't have to call it default if they don't want to bring the whole group in, correct? I mean, they can continue on working. It's only when they feel that they've exhausted all avenue and they want to go put the loan into default that this triggers the mediation. Is that correct or am I wrong?
Mr. Skillbred.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think that that's correct. And that brings up another issue. And the other issue is, if I'm a lender and I'm working with the borrower on a default and I'm unable to come to some terms, now I go through the mediation process. If it works, great. Now I've got something I didn't have. If it doesn't work, now I've wasted another 80, another 60 days, and a whole bunch of more time.
Yeah. Representative Petersburg.
But that seems to contradict what you said before, that you didn't have any choices, that other companies and other loans, you have options to work out before you go to mediation. I think you still have that here, and this is always the last resort, and it's the one opportunity that everybody has to kind of stay on the same playing field, isn't it?
No, yeah, but what I meant by that, Representative, is that if there's a $6,000 note in default and I'm working with that individual, I can work with that individual one-on-one, but if we can't come to some terms, the only alternative I have then is to go into mediation. And that seems to be a rather heavy consequence for a relatively low amount of money.
Not to the farmer. I mean, it's...
Well, you know.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Skilbred? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Or assistant chair, or whatever. I'm curious that that if you have a 24-mile trip, that you have a $6,000 issue to discuss. Why would you send an attorney? Does this have to have an attorney mediate these, or can any junior loan officer at the bank go out and talk to this farmer and try come to an agreement? Does it? When do the lawyers have to become involved?
Mr. Skilbred.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the story that I told was not one where the bank sent an attorney. The banker drove the 24 miles. The banker participated in the mediation. The attorneys, though, often are helpful in order to make sure all the mailings are sent on time to the correct people in the correct format. Because if they are not, then you have problems that develop down the road and further extensions. And so, like I said, the legal is necessary oftentimes in order to make sure that you conform and comply exactly as you are required.
All right, thank you. Any other questions? If not, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
And Chair Poppe, you can bring down your next testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we do have a replacement. We have our real live banker with us from Southern Minnesota. So I'll let him introduce himself.
All right.
Thank you, Chair.
Please state your name for the tape and proceed.
Sure, Representatives. My name is Mark Midke. I'm with Citizens State Bank of Hayfield down by Rochester, and we have three branches in Manorville, Dodd Center, and Hayfield, and then we have an affiliate bank also in Blooming Prairie and Austin. And so I'm speaking here on behalf of the MBA. I'm on the MBA board and represent Southeast Minnesota. We're primarily an ag bank. Over half of our loans are in agriculture. And I have been involved in mediation back in the 80s, and have been in banking and ag banking, you know, the whole way through. My primary purpose here today is just to discuss the limits on the mediation, having that $5,000 loan limit requiring mediation. I guess I'm not exactly certain what the initial intent of the law was, if it meant to mediate full-time farmers, part-time farmers, hobby farmers, or people that did a little bit of farming because they enjoyed it. And at this point, the what it takes to make a living farming, you all know what it takes just for a salary to make a living. And if you need to generate, $50,000 to make a living, that's your net income you have to make. And so then your gross farm income needs to be substantially more than that. Our farmers down there right now, a very small part-time farmer might farm 300 acres, and that 300 acres will generate a gross of $300,000. That's the gross income. To operate that 300-acre farm, it may take debt to put that crop in of about $150,000. Machinery, another, it varies on custom basis, but another $100,000. So a very small part-time farmer down there will have debt of $250,000 and a very substantial gross. Even if you get down to a guy that's farming 50 acres just, you know, for the heck of it, even that guy is going to have $25,000 into his crop operation, and he's going to have $50,000 of equipment. You know, you go out and buy a tractor nowadays, you can't buy a lawnmower for $5,000 anymore. Tractor takes one tractor, minor tractor is $25,000. So I'm just looking at what it takes now to run a farm operation. As far as going through the process of mediation, we haven't had any mediation in our direct bank for the last 15 years or better. But our affiliate bank has had two, but we do have a few customers that have problems. So it's not to say we don't have any problems, but as a bank, as a community bank, we kind of get thrown into this whole deal as a bank issue, but it's not necessarily a bank issue because we deal with our customers daily. If they do get into a problem, I do have a dairy farmer that is struggling right now. I'm in contact with him at least twice a week, if not more. And this has been ongoing now for a couple of years. If it comes to the point where we do have to say it's not going to work, he agrees it's not going to work, we then, after working on this for a couple of years, we will go into mediation, and I will have to get an attorney to help me put together the process because we don't do enough to know how to do all these laws, and there's a lot of different laws that we need to try to keep track of, and we just can't. So we have to hire an attorney to help us do it, and we'll mediate with them, and that's no problem, you know, and it'll be the 60 days mediation, whatever the 30 days notice is, and the 30-day cooling off period, and that'll be another 120 days or whatever it is. And then after that, then we'll get back to working with that customer again to actually try to work out how this is going to happen. So the mediation is just something that comes in between our whole process of working with our customer. I think the customer that mediation probably would work best for would be the guy that did go out and finance a tractor with a finance company or is dealing with a out-of-state finance company on their real estate who isn't in the local area, not providing any representation. That company may just send the letter and say, I want my piece of equipment back. And because they really don't worry about trying to work with a customer so much. And that's where it may be beneficial. But that piece of equipment, if you go out and purchase a yard tractor, it's going to cost you $20,000. So anybody that's even just doing, you know, minor work, minor farm work, they're going to have well over $20,000 into their operation. And so that's just why we're looking to raise that threshold so that if we do have a customer that is feeding a few beef cattle or something, farming 20 acres, has a lawnmower, they get a divorce, whatever, and they just aren't going to pay, we don't have to go to mediation for that $5,000 small item. I have no problem going to mediation for the larger ones. We do it anyway. So whether it's a mediation or whether we're just doing it, it's being mediated. So it's just part of the whole process. But we do need help in understanding how to do it. That's about most of the points I got. If anybody else has any questions, I don't have anything very formal here.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Mitke.
Mitke. Yes.
Mitke. Mm-hmm. Okay. Any questions for Mr. Mitke? No. All right. Well, thank you very much for your testimony. All right, Chair Poppy, do you have any other?
Yes, I do have somebody from the Department of Ag. Greta Gautier is here to speak as well.
All right, thank you and welcome. And please state your name for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Greta Gautier. I'm the Director of Government Relations at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify on House File 251. The Department of Agriculture and Commissioner Dave Fredrickson wanted me to just step forward today and say that we support the continuation of the farmer lender mediation and that we would be in support of this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
All right. I'll ask you the first one. Do you have an opinion on whether or not to raise the $5,000 limit?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for that question. Since there was an amendment for that, I didn't prepare for that. I do not have an opinion at this time.
All right. Thank you very much. Are there any other questions? No? All right. Thank you very much. All right. Chair Poppe, do you have any other testimony?
I do not.
Oh, question. Representative Fitzsimmons.
Yep. Chair Poppe, I was just curious, what is the, I didn't see anything as far as a fiscal note or anything, so what is the cost of the mediator? Who pays for that? Where's the revenue stream from that?
Dr. Sinise to come down and respond to that.
Thank you.
Thank you. And again, please state your name for the tape again.
Sure. My name is Dick Sinise, Senior Associate Dean with the University of Minnesota Extension. Mr. Chair, Representative Fitzsimmons, if you just give me a second, I brought some of that information with me. The program is paid for in a combination of federal funds that we have a grant through the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The National Appeals Division of the U.S. Department of Agriculture manages this program on a federal level, and then we match that with state funds. So for every dollar we spend 70 cents of federal dollars and 30 cents of state dollars. And the state funds come through a combination of funds Extension receives through the Ag State Special and the Operations and Maintenance funds at the University of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Cinti. Do you have a total dollar amount?
Yeah, the average cost per mediation is $442. The total cost of the program is $462,000.
Thank you very much.
Representative
Fitzsimmons.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. That was the number for annual or last year, or what's the?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fitzsimmons, that's the number for federal fiscal year 2012.
For 2012, okay. And that, again, was 462.
The full number, Representative Fitzsimmons, is $462,065.99.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Anderson.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair, and as long as we have Mr. Sinise up there. Looking on the back page of this handout again that showed the number of cases, the breakdown, any numbers as to how many cases had a successful conclusion in terms of an agreement actually being reached? This is not binding, I would assume, so did these mediation cases help the farmer, or do you have any numbers that pertain to that?
Mr. Sinise.
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson. On the back page, what you're looking at is, again, the initiating debt for cases that went into mediation. This isn't the total amount of debt mediated in those cases. This is that first notice that Mr. Skobred referred to. This is the number on there. On the front of the document, we find that 81% of parties that enter into mediation do reach an agreed-upon solution.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Mr. Sneed. Any other questions of any of the testifiers, I guess? Yeah, Mr. Krisha, Representative Krisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up to Representative Anderson's question. If we were to increase from, say, $5,000 to $10,000, what would be the impact on the $462,000 spent? Would that, do you know if that would go down and at what level?
Mr. Sinise.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krisha, I'd be hard-pressed to take a guess at that. I'd really rather take a look at the numbers. My sense is, and I'll look to Mary Nell, our program director, is that, again, this initiating debt number that you're seeing likely indicates that the total number of creditors and the total amount of debt associated with that case is small. We do a number of smaller mediations over the phone. So my guess is that the costs, the impact on our expenses wouldn't be high, but that really is kind of an assumption on my part at this moment. We could go back and try to determine that, though I'm not quite sure how we would do that.
All right. Thank you very much. Follow-up, Ms. Representative Krisha? All right. Any other questions? All right. Chair Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate everyone's testimony today and everyone's questions. I think this was very thorough and informative, and I appreciate that. I would move to take House File 251 to the House floor. Renew that motion.
All right. Are there any other questions, comments? If not, all those in favor of the motion to move House File 251 to pass it and move it to the House floor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Thank you very much. We now have a legislative district profile. And today's lucky winner is Representative Deb Keel. I'm still waiting for somebody to bring, like, samples from their district or something.
Just hold your breath. I brought all night. But I'm going to leave this in here for just a second. I have to show you something, first of all. I was going to put this on.
Pull your mic. Well, maybe as close as you can.
Sometimes I'm pretty loud. Anyway, I can't think of the program right now that I was at. Anyway, this says, I dig my farmer. Apron that was given out by the, what is that program? I want to say SNAP, but it's not SNAP. I was just at it, too. I'll think of it. Anyway, they wanted me to show you that, so I was supposed to wear it in here, and I forgot about that. Anyway, thank you very much. I live in District... I'm reside in District 1B, and I farm south of Crookston, about 10 miles. And on my farm, we raise wheat, soybeans, sugar beets, and then added corn this last year. So, but corn is not all that unusual in my district. I know people think that it's because of the growing season is longer, but actually I have a brother who farms and raises hogs. He's over 2,000 hogs. And it was an FFA project that expanded, and they have raised corn for, I want to say, probably about 30 years. So they've been doing that quite a long time, and of course they feed it. Although he would tell you that they don't feed as much corn as they do anymore. They do quite a bit more soybeans and ground soybeans and oil and those types of things. So it's a different mix of feed. I helped my sister-in-law one time for 2 weeks. I'm a fair-weather hog farmer and clean barns. And my father came to ask me if I wanted lunch one day and took one look at me, and I had a wetsuit on. And I typically sing when I work, and you don't when you're washing barns. And my dad took one look at me, and he said, I don't think I've ever seen anybody so full of shit in my life. Anyway, I had learned not to spray the corners. They come back on you. Anyway, my district consists of three counties, and I'm going to start with the smallest one first. It's Red Lake County, and it has four towns, two school districts, and is under 5,000 people. It has 423 square miles, 13 townships, and has about 160 people employed in agriculture. It does not have one single stoplight in the entire county. Didn't know that. But I found that out when I was doing the research. And it took me a little bit to think about it. Oh, yeah, for all I've driven around, yeah, there is no stoplight, a lot of stop signs. They have about 400 sheep and about 8,900 cows. Of that, 1,100 are dairy. So, and that used to be a huge dairy county. It's much smaller, than it used to be. And they raise soybeans, alfalfa, sugar, spring wheat, corn, barley, and there is a little bit of sugar beets around the edge. And they have a lot of CRP, and you can see that being tilled up because it's dry up there. And so some people are looking to either sell their land. A lot of retirees or people that have been retiring are starting to sell and get rid of, move on the land. And then, of course, hopefully young people are joining. And there are some. Numbers are not quite as good. But Anyway, Pennington County is my second county, and I share that with Representative Fabian. He has four of the townships and the city of Thief River Falls, which almost splits the population of 14,000 people in half. Most of them reside right around Thief River Falls, but there is a lot of rural there too, and they have three communities in Pennington County and two school districts. It is 616 square miles and has 17 townships, and about close to 300 people farm in that are employed by farming. They have some sheep, only about 200 cattle at 8,500, and they of the 85 cattle, they have 1,100 cows, or excuse me, 300 cows. That was Red Lake Falls. Raise a lot of dry edibles, soybeans, alfalfa, spring wheat, corn, oats, barley, hay, and some sugar beets. That starts to get out of sugar beet country, so it's usually only in the west portion of Pennington County that sugar beets are raised. And they also have Lando Lakes in their community that sells milk. So that's a great great township, and it's rectangular, perfectly rectangular. So of our townships, they're not always so square or, you know, have shape like that. So anyway, and my final county is Polk County, where I reside. It has 15 towns in it, 8 school districts, is 1,971 square miles, 57 townships, and 1,191 people are employed in agriculture. It is a heavily cropped area, but we also do have animals. We actually have, I didn't know this, 1,700 hogs in the district, and I do know that some do farrow to finish, which is a complete raising of hogs, and but some have contracts, so they get the little pigs and feed them out. They don't worry about the birthing stage, and that becomes quite concentrated when you're farrowing. In fact, I help my sister-in-law. She's a very, very good expert at it, and when little pigs are born, they're born with teeth, and the mothers don't appreciate that. So they are cut, they're nipped off, and it is. I had a very hard time doing that, so I offered to pick them up out of the crate. And I don't know if anyone knows this, but and probably people do. But when you pick up a small pig, you don't usually pick it up like you do a cat or a dog. You have to pick it up by its leg, preferably one of its rear legs, and it doesn't squeal. But if you pick it up by its belly, it will squeal. So you can eventually hold it in your arms, and it's fine. But initially, when you pick it up, it works better. So Polk County grows quite a few different crops, dry edible, alfalfa, sunflowers, spring wheat, soybeans, corn, oats, barley, sugar beets, and a little bit of potatoes. And we have some organic farmers in the area. So my neighbor happens to be organic, does organic alfalfa. The one unique thing about my area is I'm home to two sugar beet processing plants and also a sunflower processing company. And actually, my claim to fame on the sunflower is my father-in-law wanted to employ his employees all winter long, and so he decided to start a bird seed company. And that is how Dahlgren's, it was originally called Keel Dahlgren. And then eventually he sold out to his partner, and now it's owned by SunOpta. It's been moved a few times, and it concentrates on sunflowers, some bird seed, but processing in sunflowers now. And then American Crystal is a five-company sugar beet in the valley. But we actually are partnered with a sugar cane company in Florida. And also we have another plant that we co-opt with in Sydney, Montana. But we also combine with Mindac, which is a sugar company in Wahpeton, that we sell, market all of our sugar through, called United Sugars. United Sugars is actually based in Edina here. We are the largest sugar growing company in the United States. And I didn't think to ask how many tons that we grew this year. We had a pretty remarkable crop year, considering it was dry. Sugar beets take quite a bit of moisture. And We were talking about samples and show and tell just a second. few of my floor mates knew that I had a sugar beet in the freezer. I robbed this off of a piling station right south of my house. And robbed, I say, because they're not supposed to go take them off afterwards. So when I go home, I will return this. But I wanted to show you what a sugar beet looked like. A lot of people ask me, what does a sugar beet look like? And it's similar to a red beet, but it's considerably larger, and it will keep growing. In California, they grow for 2 years. They just harvest them as they need them, as they process them. But in northwestern Minnesota, of course, you can't leave them in the ground. They rot come spring if you don't take them out. So they need to all be taken out. They're white. This is full of mud. They are white. Usually there is a taproot that goes as far as it needs to go to find the moisture in the ground. Has a lot of roots on it. We try really hard to keep the taproot on. It's somewhat difficult. In drier years, we can have very small sugar beets. This is a fairly average one in an average year. If we cut this open, which would be a impossible exercise right now, it looks very white. It's kind of an off-white. And if you ate it, somebody asked me, what does it taste like? And I said, well, initially it tastes very sweet. There is a bitterness to it also. Sugar beets, when we process this, it also provides molasses, let's see, I'm going to think about it, and pulp. And pulp is formed in two ways. It's pelleted or in shredded pulp. And you will see in the factories trucks going out with shredded pulp. In the spring, they're a little soupy because it's organic matter that is disintegrated. But those are fed to cattle. A lot of cattle farmers in the area buy the pelleted, is easier to ship, and then also they bring out shredded. There's a lot of, and our cattle have expanded because of that. So, but I in my district, only two of the five valley sugar beets are are in the district, which is kind of unusual. They're very old. And I forgot to say that American Crystal was a company that was started in the late 1800s and was owned by another company based out of Colorado. And eventually, when they first started raising sugar beets in the valley, they were shipped on trains to Chaska. And my mother-in-law talked about how when they hired, and she helped with it some of the time, but she said she would lay at night because they worked around the clock in October, and they would, we have beet knives. It's like a long knife about so big with a hook on it. People got hurt from them too. But they would slice off the tops, the green parts of them, and then it would, the hook would pull it out of the ground. First you have to pull it out of the ground, excuse me, and then slice off the tops. Slicing off the tops is where it became problematic. So anyway, and then they were stacked. And then from there, they were picked and put in a wagon that was brought to a piling site by the railroad and then lifted. A lot of this was manual labor, physically. Everybody in the family did it, and that's the way it worked. And during the war, the prisoners of war, the German prisoners of war, were working in the fields. So that was how they worked, and the area that I grew up in is fairly heavily German, even at that. My mother-in-law was full German, and the whole entire family did sugar beet harvesting. But in the 60s, when the company decided to fold, there were already three plants in the valley, and so the farmers in the valley, and so. The farmers got together with some leadership and decided to buy the farm, or buy the co-op. And now we boast about 3,000 members in the cooperative. And like I said, we're the largest sugar grower in the United States. Trying to think if there's anything. Oh, and the one kind of neat thing is both sugar plants in my district don't sell bagged sugar. If you buy sugar off the shelf, it doesn't come from my sugar beets. It actually, my sugar beets go in a train that goes to companies like Kraft. Your Jell-O products have American Crystal sugar in them. And somebody said we should bring treats. I will pass this around. But Hershey's, Pennsylvania, is where my sugar goes. And so this is American Crystal. I got to have somebody with the strength of... Anyway, so can you do it? Oh, there you go. Thank you. They should have had it. Anyway, if you want to pass the chocolate around, this is sugar from American Crystal Sugar Crookston plant. So East Grand Forks also sends their sugar to Pennsylvania too. Or other things. Do I want a bag?
Pass those down.
I do. One without a beet in it. Oh, there you go. Thanks. Anyway, so I guess that kind of is plenty of time to wrap up. Do you have any questions at all?
Does anyone have? Yes, Representative Dill.
Thank you. Can you tell me how the my son lives in Grand Forks and he's in grad school out here.
Oh.
And he has many farmers that are friends because he's such an avid hunter. And so he's telling me that in order to grow sugar beets, you obviously have to have a place to sell them. But he said the people that have beet contracts, and in order to have a beet contract, you have to be a part of the co-op. So what he's saying is somebody just can't really buy 160 acres and plant beets because they have to have a place to sell. Can you explain that a little bit?
Exactly. Because it's a closed company, we have a contract with the company, and you can buy sugar seed from beet seed from other places. Monsanto sells it, and they have the rights to Roundup Ready beets. But the company also sells some types of beet seed, but you have to have a contract with American Crystal, or you can rent a contract from a farmer. So as our farmers retire, and they may not want to sell out their, they might want to be part of the company yet, although I know the company encourages them to sell, because we want young farmers to start. They have a contract, and they contract acres. And we don't always get to plant all of our contracted acres. They work on how many acres that they will have that year, and then depending on how the weather is, they will tell us, you know, we want you to plant 80% of your crop, we want you to plant 90. And in the recent years, we've had so many, we've had such successful crops that we've actually had to leave beets in the ground. They won't let us take them all out. And part of that is EPA regulations, because we have trouble getting rid of the beets if we can't process them all. And then the other requirement is that we need to have it, one of the EPA requirements is it costs us, or there's more particulates, a slight bit more particulates in the air supposedly in May, after May 15th, so it has to be all processed by May 15th. But in order to have a contract, you have to own the stock or rent it from someone. And I can't even tell you what that is right now. I haven't asked my son what that's costing. But farmers try to pass that down if their son's farm. It just makes it a little simpler. So, but like I said, we don't always raise all 100% of our beet stock. Go ahead.
Yes, Representative Dill.
So, thank you for that. So, I am corn. I can sell that just about any place.
Mm-hmm.
But so, could someone in Polk County buy real estate there, farm it, and have a market for their beets? Because what you're saying is, what I think I heard you say is that in order to sell your beets locally to American Crystal Sugar, you would have to have a beet contract.
Correct. You couldn't. I understand what you're saying. No, you would have to. You would have to have stock in a. You'd have to have a contract with a company. I don't know how other companies in the United States do it, but I do know that in our area, whether it's Mindac, Renville is owned by Cargill now, they have contracts with them, but you have to have a contract in order to sell your beets, bring your beets in.
All right. Representative Nornes, did you have a question?
Just a comment.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Yes, you may.
Representative Keel represents the area that I grew up in.
Yes.
And I was hoping she'd say something nice about my hometown, which is hanging in there with Ronnie's Garage and a large elevator, I think. That's about it. Is
huge,
it more than that?
Huge elevator. You, very good point. The one thing that is, because of the corn that has expanded into our area, we are watching elevators just massive. In fact, we were driving home the other day, and in... Representative Nornes's area, my husband said, look at that, we can see that elevator now, and it is expanded greatly, and you can see it. It takes about 6 miles to get there, but I can see it across country. I guess something I should have pointed out about where we live is it is very, very flat. If I don't feel like driving into town for fireworks, I go sit on my paved road, and I can watch the fireworks 10 miles away. Wow. Can't hear them very well, but I can actually watch the fireworks from my community out on my road, and that's true. Wow. There's, there's woods here and there, and my yard is covered by two rows of ash, which I'm hoping emerald ash borer stays away, because that would be very detrimental to my yard. But
finding a place to ski in that area was really difficult.
Yeah.
So we would tie a rope to the back of a bumper, and then they'd pull us down the road. So that's how we skied in those days.
Yeah, well, that's and if the kids want a sled, my son purchased a small snow sled, and you know, a little bitty one, and he pulls, my grandson that's 10, pulls the kids around in the sled, because there are no hills.
Wow.
But if you go to the golf course, they have a few. But
you have inspired some questions. We have Representative Anderson. Either questions or comments, I guess?
Just a question. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative, you have the University of Crookston in your city. Tell us a little bit what was happening with that school in terms of agriculture and ag education.
Good point. I was trying to be short and concise, and there's all kinds of things happening. I actually have the University of Minnesota Crookston campus, which used to be a high school, went to a junior college, and then now is a four-year school. It also has the Northwest Experiment Station on there, so we rely on a lot of data from there, and it is very helpful for our farmers, looking at all the things that we grow and all of the changes that we have in agriculture, or you know, how we want to provide fertilizer, or we've gone from spraying a field with a chemical entirely, the whole 80 acres, to now precisely worrying about where we, you know, dealing with the pesticide wherever it might be, specifically in that area, and the changes that University of Minnesota has provided in the Northwest Experiment Station is, I think back when I was a child, we plowed. We don't plow anymore. In fact, before I was a legislator, I planted sugar beets in the spring, and my husband tilled about 6 inches of the strip with it's called a Yetter bar. If he wanted to put fertilizer down at that point, he could also do that. Then I would follow with the beet planter. So I always blamed him if the rows were not straight. This is before GPS. We now have GPS also. But I would follow those rows and plant the beets. And all of that is part of the University of Minnesota and its research. And of course, it's wonderful to have those experts right there, whether it's grain, beets, soybeans, it's all there. They've got fields. They do a lot of training for farmers. They do the experiments, so we know how something works in a small part, but it gives us the opportunity to see a lot of things. And the University of Minnesota is expanding. In fact, we have students sleeping in a hotel, and so they just are finishing up a new dorm there. So, and they're growing. Part of their growth is by students coming to the school, but a lot of their growth is online. So students that did junior, the president was telling me the junior college students that now are a little bit older and, I think I want more of my degree, are coming back and they are doing it online. So, which is, I think, very interesting, but they've, and if you ever get to Crookston, you're all welcome to come, you got to see the University of Minnesota campus. It is a beautiful campus. They absolutely have gorgeous grounds and work very hard at their horticulture. They have a horticulture program there. And, in fact, quite a few couples have wedding pictures taken out there. Hmm. So
I believe Representative Dill had a question.
I just want to say one thing you didn't talk about in your district, but I really know it well, because you have incredible hunting opportunities. In fact, American Crystal Sugar.
Yes. Yes.
In Crookston, I mean, all we do is we go downtown and we scout from right downtown at the across from the college here, about in towards by the McDonald's, with a really good breakfast restaurant.
Yep.
We go in there and have breakfast, and we watch the geese flying out, and then we go get permission from the farmers, and the next day we hunt. And it's incredible. What, and then also at Redwood Falls, the river, and around that farm and to the east, is just some incredible hunting opportunity. And that's something that I see as we have hunted out there over the last decade, over the Thanksgiving weekend. I see more and more and more cars with decoys and trailers and people at the motels. And so it's beginning to be discovered, and so we're going to go somewhere else.
Yeah. Oh, you are correct, though. There is, it attracts a lot of geese around Crystal with the ponds. And yes, it is. It is. And then, of course, the river runs around there, so there's a lot of deer. Not as many as there used to be, but that fluctuates all the time. So,
well, thank you, Representative Keel. That was tremendous. I know that Representative Anderson did an outstanding job. I think Representative Keel upped it a bit with the show and tell and the treats. So, Representative Kresha, tomorrow is your day. If you're ready and to go to bat tomorrow, that's right. Okay, so in addition, tomorrow, just as an FYI, we're hearing, thank you, Representative Keel. We are hearing House File, I believe it's 151, and we won't be voting on that tomorrow, but we will hear about that House File 151. Then we will have a presentation also by an FFA member tomorrow, Brandon Reuger, who is, I think that's how he's, you say his name, he's going to talk to us about ag literacy, so that will be fun and interesting, and then we'll have Representative Kresha. So hopefully a good, fun day tomorrow, and otherwise, if there's nothing more, meeting adjourned.